to the Negro Leagues, our Major Leagues podcast, a production of Sports Reference. I'm your host, Curtis Harris, and today we are joined by Gary Gillette. And Gary has done a lot of stuff. He'll tell you all about it in just a moment, in his own words. But I'll give you the rundown. Gary has authored, edited, or contributed to over 24 books on baseball history. And also he's the co-founder and the chair of the board of directors for Friends of Historic Hamtramck Stadium. The goal of that group is to restore and preserve Hamtramck Stadium, which is in Michigan, near Detroit, actually surrounded by Detroit. And the preservation of that stadium will help to ensure the honoring and preservation of Negro League baseball history, as well as amateur sports in Hamtramck and Detroit. So today, as you might be able to guess, a big part of our discussion with Gary is about the history of Hamtramck Stadium, but also a discussion about just the history of baseball stadiums in general, the business of baseball, why baseball stadiums don't tend to last that long, which connects with the history of the economics behind baseball, and also just about the history of racism in American sport, baseball in particular, and Detroit and Hamtramck in particular. So Gary is a fountain of knowledge, has tons of information. So I hope you enjoy learning from what he has to say, and I hope you appreciate what he has to say. Welcome to the Negro Leagues, our Major Leagues podcast. And today we are joined by Gary Gillette. And Gary, I'd like for you to explain to listeners just who you are and what do you do concerning baseball history, and then we'll jump more into the specifics of some of your expertise.
Yeah, I'm inclined. I used to do that a lot, and it got so long. I just lately say been around a while, done some stuff. So basically, regarding the Negro Leagues, I'm working on a new edition of Jim Riley's Biographical Encyclopedia of the Negro Baseball Leagues from 1994, editing and updating it. I'm also the founder, past president, current chair of the Friends of Historic Hamtramck Stadium, which is raising money and awareness for Hamtramck Stadium, which is one of the five remaining existing Negro League ballparks, Hamtramck being a small suburb of Detroit that's actually surrounded by the city. In fact, we hope to have an announcement soon about the grandstand restoration. Sabre member since 1983, former co-chair of the Ballparks Committee, former co-chair of the Business of Baseball Committee, former Sabre board member, founder, past president, current chair of the Sabre Detroit chapter, although actually we've merged with the West Michigan chapter to become the Sabre Southern Michigan chapter now, which I'm current chair of. You know, I've contributed to a couple dozen baseball books, including Total Baseball, and I edited with Pete Palmer the ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia, which has a distinction of being the last major sports encyclopedia ever printed, because people like Baseball Reference put us out of business. And also designed and edited the ESPN Pro Football Encyclopedia. That was back 2004 to 2008, which seemed like a long time ago now. I've done a bunch of stuff, written for a bunch of people. Used to write for ESPN.com about 15 years ago. I don't know.
Hey, man, you're right. You got a lot of stuff under the belt. But out of curiosity, just where are you from originally?
Oh, I'm from the Pocono Mountains of northeastern Pennsylvania. I live in Detroit now. We moved to Detroit in 2005, but I went to school at Michigan State. So I was in Michigan previously, before back to Philadelphia and then to North Carolina.
All right. Yeah, because I was curious about your how you got involved in, you know, trying to preserve Hamtramck Stadium. But we'll get to that in a second, sure. In a bigger view. But, you know, I was just curious, you know, geographically where you're from, whether you were had Detroit roots or not. But I guess in a sense you do.
I feel like I do, because we've been here a long time. And even when we even when we lived in Lansing, my wife's a Detroit native, and even when we lived in Lansing, we spent a lot of time in Detroit, partly because she worked for a state representative who lived, or whose district was on the east side of Lansing. Plus, we both had an interest in Detroit history, and I had an interest in the Tigers, so we spent a lot of time in Detroit.
All right. Well, you know that. We'll get to the specific stadium in a moment, but first, I want to, I guess, kind of take a broader view and then kind of zoom in on Hamtramck. How did you get interested in the history of maybe stadiums generally, or maybe you always just started off with baseball stadiums? But just kind of, yeah, explain your interest in that and just how you got interested in it.
You know, I think, I've been a baseball fan since I was a kid in the 60s. Well, everyone was back then. Back then, you couldn't get away without being a baseball fan. You may not have cared a lot. It may have been football or basketball was your sport, but you had to know about baseball because everyone else did. It's like today, you don't know about baseball. People just say, oh, yeah, that's like most people. But if you don't know anything about football, you're really in trouble because you can't go anywhere without people talking about football. So I probably became really interested in ballparks in 86 when Sabre released the first edition of Green Cathedrals, which is definitely one of the top 10 baseball books ever written or edited. That was a landmark book, and it taught me a lot about ballparks I didn't know. Although going to games at Tiger Stadium when I was an undergraduate at Michigan State also got me interested in the history of Tiger Stadium. Probably the next step was getting involved with the Sabre Ballparks Committee. They were, the chair suddenly resigned in 2009, I guess it was. And so I moved over from being co-chair of the Business of Baseball Committee to being co-chair of the Ballparks Committee to help out. And that got me even more interested. But before that, I'd already begun research on Hamtramck Stadium. All it was with Hamtramck Stadium was I decided since I was living in Detroit, I wanted to visit the site of and know the history of every former ballpark here. And people think, well, that's what, Bennett Park, Maven Field, Tiger Stadium, and Comerica Park, right? Well, no, there was two important Negro League parks, Mack Park and Hamtramck Stadium. There were also some minor league parks. And there were also, you know, oddball things like when there were still blue laws in Detroit and the Tigers couldn't play home games on Sunday, they built a ramshackle wooden ballpark just outside the city limits. I think they played Sunday games there in 1901, 2, and maybe 03 as well, called Burns Park. Now that's now in the city limits, but I decided I want to go visit all these sites. And of course, the Tigers started as a minor league team in 1894. So from 1894 to 1900, they were a minor league team. And they actually, their first ballpark was a wooden ballpark about, maybe 10 blocks from where I sit now on the east side of Detroit. So I just was researching the sites, and I noticed that Green Cathedrals and some other sources had different street grid references for Hamtramck Stadium. This is at 2 a.m, literally, because I can't sleep. I got nothing to do. So I, you know, went to my computer and looked on Google Earth to see what the aerial would show. And it shows what looks like a small 1930s rusting away ballpark. But that didn't match up with the pictures I had seen of what is an extant concrete football stadium. And the history of Hamtramck Stadium as a Negro League park had become mostly been forgotten. There were a few old timers in Hamtramck and around Detroit who remembered it, but not many. Pretty much you had to be in your 90s to remember it. But its history had become conflated with what is now called Keyworth Stadium, which is a high school football stadium in Hamtramck. That's only a few hundred yards away from Hamtramck Stadium and was opened in 1936. But somewhere along the line, someone confused the history. And so if you look in the book Black Baseball in Detroit, which is published in 2000, a very good book, I still recommend it to people. And it was co-edited by Larry Lester and Dick Clark, stalwart Sabre members, co-chairs of the Negro Leagues Committee. Now, Dick has since passed, regrettably. But that book had a picture of Keyworth Stadium instead of Hamtramck Stadium because somewhere along the line, somebody signals got crossed and it just kept, you know, everyone just keeps picking up the same mistake. So I couldn't wait to get out to the site to see this for myself. And I went out to the site a day or two later and said, damn, if this doesn't look like a 1930s abandoned ballpark, I don't know what would. So I started digging in some more and figured out the mistake. And then I was just doing some research on it casually. When 2 years later, the local newspaper in Hamtramck ran an editorial saying that they should tear down the grandstand. They just called the grandstand because no one knew the history. And they said it had been abandoned at that point for about 10 years, probably 12 years at that point. And they said nobody plays baseball in Hamtramck. Hamtramck at that point is mostly Yemeni and Bangladeshi immigrants, plus a small African-American community, a Bosnian community, Bosnian Muslims, a handful of other what they call white people, which are real, what they mean are white ethnics who aren't of Polish ancestry, and a small Polish-American community, which dates back to the time when Hamtramck had 50,000 people, of which 90% of them were Polish immigrants or Polish-American. And so people weren't playing baseball. Kids were playing soccer and cricket because the Bangla kids play cricket as well as soccer. And in fact, somebody had put a cricket pitch in the outfield of Hamtramck Stadium saying, who cares? Nobody plays baseball there anymore. So I read the editorial and I went to the mayor of Hamtramck, Karen Majewski, who's still the mayor today, actually, very nice woman, who had done some work with my wife on a consulting assignment a couple of years earlier, and said, hey, you know, mayor, I can't tell you what to do. I don't live in Hamtramck. I don't pay taxes there. But you should know the history before you go demolishing this. This is a historic structure and it should be recognized. So I didn't know what would happen. I didn't know city council would say, yeah, piss on that. Who cares? Aside from the fact the city didn't have the money to restore it. And I didn't know if maybe we'd get an historic marker or a little plaque or what. But the mayor was supportive and city council, somewhat to my surprise, was very supportive. Aside from the fact nobody had any money, everyone was supportive. So I got working with a local preservationist in Hamtramck, Rebecca Bino-Savage, and she guided me and another co-founder of the Friends of Historic Hamtramck Stadium, Ian Parada, through the process of getting a National Register nomination filled out. And then 2 years later, in 2012, I presented to the State Historic Preservation Office in Michigan on Hamtramck Stadium, and they put it on the State Register of Historic Places, and they recommended the National Park Service, that it be placed on the National Register. And pretty much if the state agrees to put it on the State Historic Register, then the National Register is a foregone conclusion. So in 2012, the National Park Service placed Hamtramck Stadium on the National Register of Historic Places. And then we founded the Friends of Historic Hamtramck Stadium to raise awareness and raise money, although we raised precious little money for 5 or 6 years. And then we got to work on getting a State of Michigan historic marker put on the site, which we installed in 2014 at the Jerry Malloy Annual Negro Leagues Conference, which is sponsored by Sabre, which was in Detroit for the first and only time. And since 2014, we've managed to raise a little bit more money. We got an African-American Civil Rights Grant from the National Park Service in 2017. We, at this point, means the Friends, the City of Hamtramck, and now Wayne County, Michigan, which is where Detroit and Hamtramck are part of. We're all working together to raise money for it. So the 2017 African-American Civil Rights Grant paid most of the money for a historic structures assessment, which told us what we needed to do to rehabilitate the stadium. And we got to work on that. 2019, the Friends raised $115,000 to restore the field at Hamtramck Stadium. And we've done a pretty good job. It's a pretty beautiful field, though it lacks things like lights and dugouts and subsurface sprinklers, but we're working on that. And then in 2020, we got a new African-American Civil Rights Grant, $500,000 from the National Park Service. Wayne County, Michigan allocated $500,000 of community development block grant money. And since then, we've been looking for foundation money to get the $2.6 million needed to rehabilitate the grandstand. And we actually are almost there and should have an announcement very soon that we've got the money and construction would start this summer and be completed by the time the snow flies, hopefully.
That's pretty awesome. You're able to, you know, kind of restore this. Well, it's not finished yet, but you're in the process of restoring this stadium. And
you don't know how excited I am. I'm sorry to step on you. I didn't mean to. This is like 12 years of my life. And backstory to that, and this is why you probably won't get out in 30 minutes. I hope Sports Reference is paying you out by the hour and not by the interview. I worked for 10 years on trying to save Tiger Stadium because I was a member of the Tiger Stadium Conservancy nonprofit from 2007 until we went out of existence in 2018. And we fought to save the stadium. And then the city knocked it down for no good reason other than they were spiteful and stupid in 2009. And after that, we regrouped and tried to save the field because there was a lot of proposals to put a Walmart or a dog park or a parking lot there. And so we worked for years to prevent the city from doing that. And then in about 2014, we worked with a coalition of people to put the new headquarters of the Detroit Police Athletic League there and put a new baseball field on the site and build which is like a tiny little minor league ballpark there. And so the Detroit PAL headquarters are there now. They play baseball, football, soccer, probably even lacrosse there on the site. The only regret I have is they chose to put artificial turf on the field instead of the grass, but it is still on the site of the old Tiger Stadium field. The dimensions are the same. People say the original dimensions, but they're really the final dimensions, the dimensions the stadium went out with in 1999, which have been consistent for 40 years since the mid-50s. I actually believe that Tiger Stadium from the mid-50s to 1999 had the longest streak of consistent, unchanged dimensions in Major League history of any ballpark, but I have to prove it by looking at a whole hell of a lot of ballparks to make sure. But I would say I'm 90% confident that's true, and I will verify that someday. So I worked for more than 10 years on Tiger Stadium, and we didn't save the stadium. And then we got a nice little park with artificial turf. So I would determine not to let Hamtramck Stadium end up that way. When people talk about should we have artificial turf at Hamtramck Stadium, I tell them over my dead body. And I tell them, if you are going to do it, please, you know, come visit my grave because it will be underneath that goddamn artificial turf. I guarantee it. That's where I will be resting. So,
well, but hey, I will give you some, I will give you some credit for, you know, at least keeping the footprint of Tiger Stadium alive. Maybe not the stadium itself, but at least it was repurposed for a sporting endeavor and not turned into a Walmart or some other shopping.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, I'm still friends with a lot of people who worked on that. Many of the former other board members and people who worked on it have become my friends. And many of them help out with Hamtramck Stadium. And we all regret what happened, but almost all of us acknowledge that what we got, a Detroit PAL had a rented headquarters in a small crammed up space in Midtown. Now they're downtown, they're on a historic site. They have this beautiful space. They have, it's a really worthwhile thing. It's just the sight of the artificial turf makes my skin break out in hives, you know?
That leads me to one part. We'll dive back into the Negro League specifics in a moment. But I think this is a good point to kind of jump off and discuss the importance of sports stadiums in general to kind of the city and urban landscape. Just what kind of, maybe in your opinion, in your research, just what kind of, I don't know, vibes or what kind of feelings do they give to a city that's kind of lost once that stadium is taken away?
You know, I have to say that Americans spend way too much money and way too much time, invest way too much emotion in sports, particularly professional sports. Because if we invested that in our schools, we wouldn't have the problems we do, especially in the inner city. So almost every major city in the country, especially in the Rust Belt, has 1, 2, 3, 4 major league teams. Sometimes 5 if you count Major League Soccer, which I don't think is at that level yet, but a lot of people do. And we invest literally billions of dollars in their futures and literally hundreds of millions of dollars in most cities subsidizing owners who are frequently billionaires and players who are generally millionaires. And we don't spend that time or emotion or attention on the schools. I mean, just look at Detroit. Detroit public school system is a wreck. But Detroit has these 4 first-rate facilities in Comerica Park, Ford Field, and 3 first-rate facilities, 4 teams, Little Caesars Arena, which hosts to both the NHL Red Wings and the NBA Pistons. But they are first-rate facilities, and these have 4 you know, major league teams, while huge sections of the city are crying for development, are crying for better schools, better parks. I mean, you know, a lot of parks in Detroit are being maintained by volunteers and nonprofits because the city can't afford to maintain them. So I think our priorities are out of whack. That said, people are incredibly invested in sports teams. I mean, 50, 60 years ago, if you were in Philadelphia and you weren't a Phillies or an Athletics fan, you were basically nobody. It's like people look at you like, what planet did you come in from? Now, of course, it's the Eagles and the Sixers more than the Phillies, but the Phillies are still prominent. In Detroit, you know, the Lions dominate the conversation 12 months a year, 365 days a year. The Tigers, even when they're winning, which of course they are not now and haven't for some years, even when they're winning, they're playing second fiddle to the Lions. But Detroit is a great baseball town. And I think for better or worse, and a lot of it is worse, most people identify the health and vibrancy and cool factor of their city with their sports teams. I mean, look at Baltimore. Baltimore is a Rust Belt city, down on its luck. Just think of the difference in Baltimore's reputation after Camden Yards and the Inner Harbor. Now, the Inner Harbor came first, but it was Camden Yards that just took it to a whole new level. It's just who you are. You know, when you travel, you wear a t-shirt or a jersey or a cap that says what your hometown sports team is. That's how you can identify at an airport in Rome whether somebody's from Detroit, right? Because they have a Tigers or a Lions or Pistons cap or t-shirt or sweatshirt or something. So I think it's good in the sense that people have something that brings them together. Like in Detroit, Detroit is incredibly polarized. The racial polarization in Detroit, especially between the city and the suburbs, is just absolutely enormous. I think it's probably the worst in the country, although I can't tell you. I, you know, lived in Philadelphia and spent a lot of time in Chicago, so I can compare that and Baltimore and New York. But, you know, I really don't know that much about St. Louis. It might be worse than St. Louis, but Detroit, it's terrible. And the Tigers and Lions and the sport teams give people a chance to come together. Now, albeit not all that's first-rate conversation, because on opening day in Detroit, you have tens of thousands of white people from the suburbs come downtown and get drunk because they can't get tickets to the game. Well, there are 42,000 people at Comerica Park, many of whom are drunk. There are probably twice that many in the bars and restaurants in downtown Detroit who are drunk, even though they didn't get a ticket to the game. So there is some conversation. A lot of it is, you know, stop pissing on my car's tire, or, you know, or don't you dare upchuck on me, you know, kind of stuff. But that's just stupid. But there is, when the teams are winning, people feel good about themselves and they feel more charitable toward their fellow citizen. God knows we need a lot more of that in the U.S. And in Detroit.
In that answer,
You didn't expect a lot of that, did you?
Well, no, but there's a nugget in there that got to one of the other issues I want to tackle, which was you're discussing how, you know, the cities and governments invest so much money into stadiums because they symbolize certain things. But on the, you know, taking the flip side of that, when the cities don't preserve certain stadiums, I think that also signifies, you know, something. And, you know, we got to get to what that something is. So that leads me to the, you know, why there's so few Negro League baseball stadiums left. Obviously, of course, any older stadium is not likely to survive, you know, with your example of the Tiger Stadium. You know, there are very, very, very few Negro League baseball stadiums left. Try to get off the top of my head, but I think there's an article I read that said there's about 8 of them that are left in the country.
Well, the most common figure you see is 5, and that's because of me, because I've been hammering that for the last 5-6 years. Different people count differently. Kevin Johnson was a ballpark expert, my former co-chair, the ballparks committee. He maintains a Seamheads database. Great guy, and an expert. Kevin can give you a list of, like, I don't know, 50 or 60 places where Negro League teams played. But see, he's counting any place they played, whereas I'm saying it's got to be the home park, the primary home park,
more specific,
a major Negro League team from 1920. Well, I count to 1950, but Major League Baseball said 48. And it's got to have a meaningful amount of structure left, and it's got to have the field there. And so because I set those criteria, we get this little box of jewels of five. I mean, there are a few others. I'm actually writing an article for you, being Baseball Reference, now, about the existing Negro League parks. I mean, for example, there's a football stadium in Montgomery, Alabama, Crampton Bowl. Apparently, it's fairly famous there, and it has long football history. Well, the Negro League, Montgomery Gray Sox, and I think maybe another team played there. But for most of the time, Montgomery was a minor league club. But in 1932, one year, the Negro Southern League was a major league, and the Montgomery Gray Sox were a major league team, and they played there. The problem is that in 2011, most of the existing structure that dates back to 32 was torn down. And the only thing that's left of where the Montgomery Gray Sox and other Negro League teams played in 1932 is a long football style grandstand that had been the first base side and right field grandstand. The area behind home plate, the entry plaza, the roof of the grandstand, and the third base side, they're all torn down. So, like, I don't really consider that significant. Now, you can argue, I mean, there is some structure there. And by weight of concrete, and steel, the amount of structure there is probably five times what's left at Hamtramck Stadium. But at Hamtramck Stadium, we at least have the core of the grandstand behind home plate. Yeah, they tore down the third base wing in 1972 or something. And yeah, it's not a big, you could probably squeeze 2,500 people in there when we're able to restore it. You'll probably be able to squeeze about 2,500 people in there. And it's not elegant. It's going to be bleacher seating. It's not anything fancy, but by God, Josh Gibson stood on that mound, faced Satchel Paige standing on the mound. Josh Gibson stood at home plate facing, well, actually, I don't know that Gibson and Paige faced either. They both played there, damn it. You know, Smokey Joe Williams pitched on that mound for a Detroit team. You know, Satchel Paige pitched there. Josh Gibson hit there. Mule Suttles, Willie Wells, Turkey Stearns, the greatest black ball player ever to play in Detroit. And that's no disrespect to Willie Horton or Lou Whitaker, both of whom I love, and I am still pissed that the Hall of Fame hasn't put Lou Whitaker in yet. You want to look for racism in sports, look no further than Lou Whitaker getting, you know, dissed in the Hall of Fame elections. But Turkey Stearns is one of the greatest sluggers in baseball history. And that means white or black. He is a superstar. I mean, I think of him as one rung below Willie Mays. He was a 5-2 player. He could hit for average. His career batting average, the best we can tell, is .349. He hit even better than that in exhibitions against white teams or white. He hit for power. He hit more home runs in official Negro League games than Josh Gibson. Now, admittedly, he had a slightly longer career and more games to do it in, but he's probably the second best home run hitter in the Negro Leagues of all time. He was a terrific center fielder. He could run and steal bases. He was a 5-2 player. I guess I think of him as a left-handed hitting, older version of Willie Mays. That was his home field for the majority of his career. Now, he played the Chicago American Giants and the Kansas City Monarchs, played 1 year in Philadelphia. You're not in Philadelphia, right?
I'm out in D.C., but...
You're out in D.C., okay.
But the Baseball Reference mostly is in Philadelphia.
Right. So Sean and company are in Philadelphia. So he played 1 year in the 30s for the Philadelphia Stars. His home base was Detroit. And he, even though he was born in Nashville, and that's where he got his start in professional baseball, playing in the Negro Southern League in 1920, he came to Detroit in 1923 to play for the Detroit Stars. Now his major league debut was in Detroit in 23. And he stayed the rest of his life here. He died in 1979. He got married twice. He raised a family here. His two daughters are still alive. I'm friends with them both, I'm glad to say. His granddaughter, and they're just great people. They're in the community here. They were all school teachers. Joyce Stearns Thompson, Rosalind Stearns Brown, both retired school teachers. Vanessa Ivy Rose, the granddaughter, is a current school teacher. This is precious stuff. I mean, and I do mean literally precious.
Yeah. So in your in your research, why do you think it is? I mean, I think the obvious answer is racism, but like to dig in deeper into it, why do you think so few Negro League stadiums are left standing, you know, in whatever capacity or yeah, in whatever shape they're in, why are there so few of them left?
Yeah, and I have to differ a little bit here, because actually I think the racism quotient, and there's racism here, is probably less in terms of knocking down Negro League ballparks than it is in other parts of baseball. Because think about how many old Major League parks are around. Yeah. There's Wrigley, there's Fenway. Where we're going after that, the third oldest or the oldest ballpark in the majors beside Wrigley and Fenway is Dodger Stadium. And most people don't think of Dodger Stadium as an old ballpark. Now, you know, it was opened in 1962, so that's almost 60 years, but people don't think of it the same way as the ballparks built before World War II. But I mean, in almost every case, when a new major league ballpark opened in a city, the old one was torn down. And the most common location for a new major league ballpark since the Camden Yards building boom happened with Retro Park is in the parking lot of the old ballpark. Check out Guaranteed Rate Field in the parking lot or across the street from the original Comiskey Field. Comerica Park is actually somewhat of an exception to that. It's probably a half mile away from Tiger Stadium, but it's still in downtown Detroit. You know, when they built a new Globe Life park in or field in Texas, where is it? It's basically in the parking lot of the old place, right? And so the cost of maintaining an old ballpark is not trivial. The reuse factor is very high. I mean, it's very hot, expensive to restore, remodel, renovate these. And the owner of the new ballpark, whether it's the city, the county, or the team, doesn't want competition from the old one. They don't want when Bruce Springsteen or Beyonce comes to town, they don't want the old ballpark there to compete with them for that concert date, right? They don't want a minor league team playing across the street from them or a mile down the road in the old team, in the old ballpark, competing with them. They want it knocked down so they have a monopoly on events, and that's what they get. You know, and in general, it's part of the deal. Part of the deal of finance the construction of the new ballpark almost always is we're going to knock down the old one. So I think that the fact that there are very few Negro League parks left, it's just part of the let's destroy the old ballpark mentality. However, there weren't very many ballparks that Negro League teams owned, which is a real sort of unknown factor in Negro League's history. One of the reasons Negro Leagues had so many stability issues and financial issues is they didn't control their own ballparks.
Yeah, I've talked about that with yeah, with other folks on the on interviews thus far. They mentioned like, you know, that's just a fact of the instability that you mentioned, where white major league teams more often own their stadiums, whereas the black teams were, they struggled, you know, to have the stable major league cachet because they were not able to control their, right. Yeah, their places of play.
Right. And even if the white major league teams didn't own the park, they were the major tenant, and therefore they got what they wanted. Whereas the Negro League teams, if they were renting a park from a major league team or a minor league team, like the Birmingham Black Barons rented Rickwood Field from the Birmingham Barons, which was a minor league team, right? That meant they had to wait till the schedule for their host was set before they could even start looking at dates. That meant if the, you know, if June 20th was a local holiday or a big day in town, they weren't playing at home then because the white team got that date. You know, the white team picked what it wanted and the black team had to work around it. And even to the fact that if the white team had a rain out and reschedule a game, they would bump the black teams. So the fact that, that the black teams didn't control the venue, even if they didn't own it, was even more important in some ways. And then, of course, the other thing is in the African-American community, how did you accumulate capital prior to World War II? You accumulated capital by running a funeral parlor, ergo the Chicago American Giants, one of the most famous teams in Negro League history and in Black baseball history, was owned in the 30s by a guy who ran Cole's Funeral Home on the south side of Chicago. They were called Cole's American Giants by a lot of people then, because that's how he got his capital. But the other way to accumulate capital was to be a numbers banker. And so Branch Rickey and a lot of well, I would call Ricky racist on this, even with what he did for Jack Robinson and integration. They dismiss the Negro Leagues as being corrupt and being, well, Ricky called them barely above organized crime because of the involvement of so many gamblers and numbers bankers in the African American community with the teams. Either they were owners or they were partners or they were investors. And sometimes it was hidden and sometimes it wasn't. And even if it was hidden, the word in the street was, you know, so-and-so is an investor in this team. But what did you expect them to do? There was no other way for them to accumulate capital. And because it was so hard to accumulate capital, it was even, I mean, it's hard enough to buy a team and pay the salaries and run the risk of losing money. It's even harder than to buy property and build a ballpark.
Yeah, that gets to the avenues of opportunity. Why businessmen were allowed, you want to use the term, more legitimate ways to make and maintain wealth, whereas Black businessmen or aspiring Black businessmen back in that era did not have those doors open to them. So,
yeah, well, white society deemed gambling and the numbers as illegitimate and corrupt until it became a revenue source for state lotteries, and then it became nice, you know?
Yeah. Yes, there's many, many contemporary examples that we will not discuss because it's more historically minded and also focused on baseball. But most definitely, you can see shades of that in other current legalization efforts of other business activities.
Right.
to put it diplomatically. But to start wrapping things up here, I think clearly we've been getting at it through the entire interview thus far. But if you have to maybe, like in a nutshell, explain to people why it's important for them to not know every little detail, but just be aware of the world of Negro League baseball and the importance of stadiums in sports. Like, why should someone on the street that you just drag off the street, why should they care about any of this?
Well, to me, the importance of the site, whether it's a field where people played or hopefully a structure, a grandstand, maybe a monument, the left field wall at Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, where you can see where Mazeroski hit that famous home run to win the 1960 World Series. That's part of our DNA in any area. And as I said, we certainly invest too much time and emotion and money in sports, but we do. And so it's part of our DNA. As for the historic nature of the site, I don't know why going to a site and looking at something that isn't there is so important, but it is. Think about cemeteries. People go to cemeteries all the time to see the graves of famous people. And what are they doing here? There's nothing but a hunk of stone. And you could get a picture of that on the web now. Why bother to go? But somehow there's something important about standing there in front of the grave of a person that you cared about or a person that you read about or a person that was famous that makes it a pilgrimage to people. Now, personally, cemeteries aren't my thing. I think it's bad juju to go to cemeteries and hang out. I do. But ballparks are my thing. And every place I go, every place I travel, I go to the site of former major league, minor league, and Negro League ballparks. And now these Negro League parks are mostly major league parks now. I got to remember not to separate them. And so to me, there's something magical about standing there and trying to imagine what it was like in 1930 when the Detroit Stars and St. Louis Stars and Willie Wells and Turkey Stearns were facing off against each other in the Negro National League Championship Series. What was that like? What was it like, you know, when the Birmingham Black Barons played the Homestead Grays in the last Negro World Series at Rickwood Field with Willie Mays, who was 17 or 18 at the time, unbelievably young, just had so much talent, you couldn't contain him. And the Homestead Grays, now Josh Gibson died a year earlier, tragically. We all know he died just before Jack Robinson reintegrated the majors. But Buck Leonard was still on that team. And so going to Rickwood, which I did the first time about 5 years ago, I'm just standing there looking around. I'm trying to imagine that. We'll soon be able to see things like that with augmented reality. I just had a conversation with someone about using augmented reality to show the history of these sites in a different way. And we're going to invest in that at Hamtramck Stadium. as soon as we can get the grandstand restored and some more improvements to the field. So, I mean, the sites are magical to people, even when the structure isn't there. And when there's some structure there and the field is there, especially the field is so important. The greensward, the pitcher's mound, the infield, you know, that's so important to baseball fans. It's a pilgrimage. It's a secular religion.
Yeah. Yeah. The term we use for it, I'm a historian by training. I have a degree in public history. So we public historians call that the power of place, where you can know a story, you can read about a story, but once you actually go to the place where the story happened, it just takes on a different relevance, has a different power than it is, you know, just being words on a piece of paper or words out of somebody's mouth. Once you're actually in the place the place where it happened, it just hits different than seeing it on a book. So definitely agree with you on there. Different places have different feels. The cemetery is different than a ballpark, but they each evoke different feelings. So right. I think, as you've been saying throughout the pod here, it's important to preserve, you know, as many of these spaces as possible, so people can actually get those feelings and learn history, but also just have the experience of history, I think, in those environments.
Right. And, you know, I am not a trained historian like you, and I'm certainly not a preservationist by training. I was always worried we wouldn't get the National Register listing because there's so little of Hamtramck Stadium left. The ballpark is built in 1930, probably seated about 8,000-9,000 people. The reason you don't get an exact figure is because first of all, it was almost all bleacher seating. There are only two rows of chairs in the front of the grandstand, almost all bleacher seating. And back then, you just sold as many tickets as you could. And then you told the people in the bleacher seats, to squeeze closer together. And when you finally got everyone hip to hip, butt to butt, down the bleacher so you couldn't sell any more seats, you then roped off the sidelines, the foul territory, and asked people to stand behind ropes. And if you filled the foul territory with a rope down the first base side and the third base side, and it was so crowded people couldn't see, then you roped off part of the outfield. People stood behind ropes in the outfield. People don't remember that. They sold as many tickets as they could. So the grandstand probably held 8,000 to 9,000. Now it's it's about a third of that, maybe even a little less. But it's still there. It's still there. And the field is still there. And the site is still there. And the story of how the Negro Leagues ended up in a Polish community is a really important and powerful story. It's especially important because aside from Germans, who would be the dominant ethnic group in Detroit, except they're so well assimilated that no one thinks of German Americans. There's no German town. There's no German section, really. But the east side of Detroit was the central part of the Polish American community. And Poles and Polish Americans represent the second largest ethnic group in Detroit. In fact, while people don't know it, Detroit is as Polish as Chicago is. And Chicago boasts of being the largest city in the world, Polish city in the world, outside of Warsaw. The difference is Detroit is smaller. But the percentage of Polish Americans and Poles in Detroit is about the same as in Chicago. And so the Polish ethnics on the east side of Detroit, that was their home. That was their home base. And Hamtramck was like ground zero for that. Because of decades of racial strife between white people and black people in Detroit, culminating, you could say, in the 67 rebellion, but there was plenty of ugly stuff before that. There was actually a riot during World War II where white people, gangs of white people, were roaming around pulling black people off the street and beating them up. And there were some black gangs not being organized gangs like the Crips or Blood, just being groups of people out for no good. It was really ugly. But 67 took the cake, and it was really an armed invasion of Detroit by the National Guard and state police, who just started shooting black people, you know, black men, because they were there. So there's a really long, ugly racial history in Detroit, of which Polish Americans and African Americans were frequently at odds. But prior to World War II, that wasn't the way it was. Hamtramck was welcoming to African Americans. African Americans and Polish Americans and Poles directly from Poland, they weren't even Polish Americans yet, worked side by side on the line at Dodge, Maine, which is one of the biggest auto factories in the country. I haven't been able to verify exactly. They had at least 35,000 people working there then. It may have had as many as 50. I've seen the 50,000 figure, but I'm a little bit skeptical. 30, 35,000 seems to be. That's a lot of people. And they built a lot of cars and they drank a lot of beer. And many of the African-Americans in Hamtramck learned to speak Polish because it was a dominant ethnic group. And there were white doctors and dentists who treated Black patients. There was at least one Black doctor and I think one Black dentist who treated white patients, and people would go to them. White people rented flats. A lot of the bigger housing in Hamtramck is two-story houses where families would live on the ground floor and rent the upstairs flat. White families rented to Black families. Sometimes Black families could rent to white families. More importantly, Black families could buy houses in Hamtramck. In Detroit in 1930, when the Detroit Stars moved there, probably 95% of Detroit was excluded from having African Americans buy a house or buy property by deed restrictions, which were still legal back then. There were only a couple of sections of Detroit where Black people could buy houses or property. Most of them crowded into Black Bottom Paradise Valley, which was effectively the ghetto, and where property values were way too high because of the Black people didn't have any choice of where to go. And when Black people try to move into white neighborhoods, aside from being terrorized and threatened with being murdered or bombed out of their houses by white people, they had to pay a huge premium to buy a house to get white people to sell them the house. So there's a long, ugly history. But before World War II, Hamtramck was not racial utopia. It was a pretty good place. Hamtramck high school students in the mid-30s, and I can't remember the year, forgive me, staged a walkout. Black and white students staged a walkout to protest a segregated event. The Hamtramck High School principal in the 30s refused to rent their auditorium or gymnasium to the Catholic high schools for segregated events. The Black fans of Detroit Stars in 1930 boycotted the club in midsummer because the white owner of the Stars made some very racist remarks to people about, because he was being criticized for not advertising in Black newspapers and not giving Black people better jobs at the ballpark. Now, I never got a list of which jobs they got, but I'm pretty sure it was janitor and maybe groundskeeper. But the good jobs, which would have been concession jobs and ticket selling jobs and things like that, they were reserved for white people. So when he was called out on that, he gave this very racist interview. And so the Black fans, led by a group of Black sports writers, organized a boycott. And the Stars almost went bankrupt. And after a Sunday, which I think was a doubleheader in August, in July or August, where the Stars drew like 1,000 people, and Sundays were their big paydays. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when they needed to draw 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people to make the payroll that month. When they drew 1,000, maybe plus or minus 200, it might have been a little bit less than that for that Sunday. All of a sudden, the white owner said, "Okay, I cry uncle. I'm going to step back." And this Black man, Mose Walker, is going to take over running the club. No one knows whether John Rosink, the white owner, transferred ownership to Mose Walker. I don't think he did. I think he probably still owned the club. But from that point on, the Black man ran the club and Rosink stayed in the background. And that's important stuff. Economic boycotts, civil rights boycotts in 1930 in a northern city, that's not common at all. And there are other examples. The mayor of Hamtramck led me to some letters in the city archives recently where racist white people, including a group, I think that was German-American, and I think a group of homeowners. In Detroit, you had homeowners associations who would organize to keep Black people out of their neighborhoods. They protested that the city had leased land to build this ballpark for the Negro Leagues. And first of all, the city didn't lease the land, a private company did. But I've seen the letters between the city attorney and city council saying, what do we do about this? And a couple of the letters from these racist people protesting it. And basically the city attorney said, tell them to piss off. You know, tell them that we didn't rent them the land. The contract is already signed. Tell them to piss off a little bit more politely. And I actually have seen these letters. So, I mean, again, Hamtramck was not racial utopia. And we could have a 24-hour podcast about all the ugly things that happened in Detroit between white people and Black people in the history of Detroit, especially starting in World War II with the Sojourner Truth riots, which were only, God, where they're probably 2 miles away from Hamtramck Stadium. and the 67 Rebellion. I mean, we could go on and on. But at that point, it made perfect sense if you owned a Negro League team to plunk it down in Hamtramck. Hamtramck had a small African-American community historically. Probably at that point, it's about 8-10% of the city. But there were Black people living there. And Hamtramck had there was a trolley car line, streetcar line that went right down the main drag of Hamtramck that took many African-American workers from their residences in Black Bottom to work in the auto factories. That streetcar line also went right by Hamtramck Stadium. It was a great move. And paradoxically, unfortunately, some other writers who didn't get the story right 30 years ago said it was a bad move because the place the Stars were playing on the east side of Detroit was actually a better neighborhood, which is not true. The Stars were actually chased out of. I've uncovered the story of how the Stars were chased out of their ballpark on the east side by racist white neighbors in 1929. That story hasn't been told well yet, and I'm going to tell it. And they even said that Hamtramck was harder to get to, when in fact it was easier to get to. It was a shorter ride on the streetcar, which is not by a lot, but it was shorter. And more importantly, depending on where you lived in Black Bottom or Paradise Valley, you wouldn't have to pay a transfer. Now, transfers back then were like 2 cents. The streetcar fare was 5 cents. You and I think of 2 cents as like, we wouldn't pick it up off the street. We wouldn't even pick up shiny pennies off a clean sidewalk. Never mind the scummy pennies you see in the gutter. Mm-hmm. And yet back then, two cents could probably buy you 2 eggs and a piece of toast for breakfast. And if it couldn't, 5 cents could. And so, you know, to people who were scraping for literally every penny, the difference between 5 cents and 7 cents was important. Somewhere I got lost. So I don't know. Anyway, to me, this is incredibly important. And the story is as important as the site, but the story comes alive when you go to the site.
Yeah, no, thank you for the explanation, or I guess the, I don't know, recitation sounds too much, but whatever. The explanation of, you know, the ethnic and racial dynamics of the city, Hamtramck specifically, because, you know, it's a small city, as you said,
it is
completely enveloped by Detroit, but the history of the larger city or the urban area, I guess I should say. But no, thank you, Gary, for giving us this background and this history on stadiums, Hamtramck in specific, but also also a lot of unexpected business history involving Negro League baseball. Not what I envisioned initially, but that's the cool thing about conversation. It takes you places you didn't expect.
It's been a great learning experience for me in the last 10 years, especially, but 15 years to learn all this stuff. I mean, I was interested in Negro League before. I read Only the Ball Was White. So again, one of the top 10 baseball books ever written. And it opened my eyes to lots of things. And I could name, you know, a Hall of Fame team of Negro Leaguers, you know, 30 years ago, mostly by reading Only Ball Was White. And as a Sabre member, I would see articles by the Negro League scholars, but I wasn't one of them. And it wasn't until I moved to Detroit that I really got involved. And regrettably, the passing in 2014 of Dick Clark, one of the top Negro League scholars of all time and co-chair of the Sabre Negro Leagues Committee for, I think, 20 years, maybe more. Dick's passing left a vacuum in the resident knowledge of the Detroit Stars and Negro Leagues in Detroit. The guy who knew the second most was Rick Meister, another Sabre member and a good friend of Dick Clark's. And he died not long after Dick, a couple years after Dick. And that sort of left me by default to answer the questions. And I've been doing my best to uncover the history.
Thank you, Gary, for sharing the history of the Hamtramck area, Detroit area, Negro League baseball and stadiums. I've learned a lot, and I'm glad you're able to add this to our series, The Negro Leagues Being Major Leagues.
Right. And I am grateful for the interview. I can't wait to see this stuff on baseballreference.com. But there's a lot more work to be done, and I'm working on it. I'm working on my own little corner here in Detroit. I've still got stuff. I'm still discovering stuff about the Negro Leagues in Detroit that nobody's figured out yet, mostly because nobody was looking.
So once again, I'd like to express my appreciation for Gary Gillette, for participating with the Negro Leagues, our Major Leagues podcast. And once more, I'd like to again express the importance as well of the power of place. History is extremely important. I hope you all are, if you haven't already, in your life thus far, but I hope you're gaining an appreciation for history through these podcasts. And next time you go somewhere that's a historic place, just kind of soak in the fact that you're where something important happened. You know, whatever that important thing is. And appreciate the people, the museums that preserve those spaces for posterity. Because once you lose that space, it's kind of hard to get it back, if impossible. Yeah, don't wait too late to appreciate something. Appreciate it while you got it. See y'all next time here on the Negro Leagues, our Major Leagues podcast.